good morning. Welcome to AV Daybreak. I am Mark Coxon, and as always, I'm here with Jared Hillman. How are you, Jared?
I'm good, Mark. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a Wednesday. It's back. It's back. We're AV Daybreaking. I'm Ozone, and you're Turbo, and we're like Electric Boogaloo, like Beat Street.
I think you're. I don't know if I was alive for that.
I don't know that you were. I was barely alive for the breakdancing movie era, but I remember as a kid like watching those guys on TV, and it was amazing.
Were there breakdance fights?
Yeah, they had like battles. It was like West Side Story with breakdancing.
Yeah. I don't think that was me. I don't think I was around during that time.
So in AV Daybreak, in AV Daybreak tradition, have you seen the Norm MacDonald SNL skit of West Side Story?
I have not. But you sure like Norm MacDonald.
I love, actually, you know what? It's funny. I really do. I love Norm MacDonald for some reason. Maybe a little too telling. But they do this piece with West Side Story, and he's sitting on the stoop with this kid. And then the kid jumps up and he starts singing a song, and he's like, "What the hell is that?" Like, just like.
Why are you breaking out in song and dance?
Exactly. And then somebody else comes up and then they're talking, and then all of a sudden they break out, and he's like, it was like you guys like choreographed that or something, because they're dancing around together. And then when the other gang arrives, finally, like all his people jump out and they do little pirouettes and stuff when they like, "I'm in for the fight," and he jumps up in the air and does a little spin, and he's like, "Oh no, this isn't going to be good."
I like that type of comedy. I like when comedians take things that are, you know, not realistic, and they're supposed to be entertaining, and they, I don't know, what would you say? Would they literalize them? Is that kind of maybe what, you know?
Yeah. Because in a musical, you have to kind of suspend reality, right? Like you as the viewer have put yourself in this mindset that it's a musical and that everything's going to be put to music. And then, you know, he lifts that whole suspension, you know, takes it out, and be like, if somebody was sitting there and people just broke out in song, it'd be pretty strange, right? So,
have you ever seen Will Ferrell? I think it's Will Ferrell. I hear his voice anyways doing it. There's a skit that Will Ferrell does with Don't Stop Believing by Journey. And he's like having a conversation with Journey as they're singing. So it's like, where did you say she was from? And it's like, oh, she's just a small town girl. And then they cue the chorus, right? And he's just yelling the whole time, like, where is she from? Oh, that's not good.
Those are great.
What kind of world does she live in? Oh, it's lone. And then he's like, and then they cue the song again, right?
Yeah, that is so funny. That's awesome. I love that kind of stuff too, where you just take the device out of it, right? Like I think you're right. You almost literalize it, right? You bring it right into like, what would the literal interpretation of this be, and how ridiculous is that?
You know what's funny is I was thinking about that with a show that my youngest watches, Paw Patrol. And what's funny, you know Paw Patrol?
Yeah.
Do you know Paw Patrol? Like, your kids are older, so I don't know. But
no, I know Paw Patrol. Okay.
So for those of you that don't know, Paw Patrol is a show about a group of super pups, dogs, if you will, and their owner or master rider, who looks to be approximately 13 or 14 years old.
Okay.
And I have a ton of issues with this show. My son loves the show, but I have a ton of issues with it. And then the other day I caught myself thinking about why I was thinking about what I was thinking about. And what it was I was catching it while I was getting ready for work, and he was watching a bit of it. And I'm going, man, I said, you know, okay. So context, they have this town, and this town has, you know, eight main characters, and somehow, and these are adults, somehow these eight main adults are the most incompetent people you've ever met. And they always find themselves in precarious positions and in trouble, and they rely on the Paw Patrol to come and help them.
Of course.
And so I was watching this, and I'm going, and you know, Ryder and the Paw Patrol crew are helping their neighbors do something, and I'm thinking, where are the police in all this? Like, why does this town not have a police force? And then I started thinking, why am I evaluating why this town doesn't have a police force when there are also a team of talking dogs that drive vehicles and answer phone calls like they're human? And so I just caught myself analyzing a very strange part of the show. But the show, I just don't understand the show. I watch it and I go, man, where is this town that relies on these?
What is this place? Where is this place? I had a similar experience in the movies. It wasn't me that I think had this moment of clarity, but it was this woman next to me. We were at the movies watching this movie, a Disney film with my kids, Enchanted, with Amy Adams, where Amy Adams is a cartoon character that gets thrown into New York City, right? And she has all like the powers a cartoon character would have. She can enlist animals to help her do chores. She sings out of nowhere. And, you know, she can make the sun shine when it's raining, like all of those things, right? And so we go through this whole movie. And for anybody who hasn't seen it, maybe I'm spoiling something. But anyways, we go through this whole movie. And, you know, at the end, they're fighting this dragon. And the man she likes starts to fall off the building. And she throws a sword across, and the sword sticks in the side of the building through his sleeve, and it saves him from falling, right, as she's fighting the dragon. And this woman next to me goes, yeah, right. And I'm like, okay, so this is where we lost you, like the cartoon character coming to life, and the pigeons doing the roaches doing the dishes, and the pigeons, you know, singing in the window. This was all good. Everything was good until we threw the sword. Now all of a sudden,
this was the crux. That was the crux of reality for her. You know, my daughter does that sometimes when we're watching. You know, we're watching a show like, you know, a Disney that's like Lilo and Stitch or something where the characters are not real. It's not based. You know what I mean? Like these are alien creatures. These are fantasy creatures. Whatever. And she'll call out things like that. And I look at her and said, really? That's where we're going? Like, that's, you're concerned that there's no way they could ever do that? You're concerned the little alien could never do that before?
It is funny what we, I guess, what we choose, like, the agreements we make. The agreements we make when doing entertainment, where those lines, where the shark jumping happens, for sure.
See, like, if she would have said that when Amy Adams gets, like, sucked into the cartoon world, right? If she, or whenever that transfer happens, like, at the beginning.
Yeah.
If she would have been like, yeah, right, then it's like, okay, you're right. Like, that's not real. You're not going to transverse to a cartoon world and back to reality. That's not real.
Yeah. That could happen, right?
But she watched the whole movie and waited to the end, and then, yeah. It was like she could ever throw that sword right there while she's fighting a dragon. What is she, a Krav Maga expert?
Exactly. And what is that anyway?
Yeah. All right, what are we talking about today?
I don't know. I mean, you've been busy. I heard you were doing you're doing some case studies for your business. What's going on with that?
Yep. That's right. Yeah, I did my first we've always done case studies. This is we've always done case studies. I mean, we've always done the written case study. And so this year I said, even though it's late in the year, thanks 2020, this year I decided we're going to do a video case study. And so we selected a client that, you know, would allow us to do it, and that we have a good working relationship with and has a good system to show. And so Monday we went and we did a video shoot case study on basically a new office space. It's not a huge place or a huge facility. It's not a multi-deployment of rooms. It's three rooms, and it's fairly straightforward, but we just love the flexibility and the use of the room. But yeah, you're right. I was telling you about this, and what I liked about it was this room is actually like a year and a half old.
Yeah.
And as I was sitting there listening to the interview questions come to the client and the employees on the space, I was thinking about how my mindset has always been wrong about when we should do case studies, because I think traditionally, and you can correct me, you have probably more experience in writing case studies from a broad range of, you know, manufacturer case study based to integrator case studies. And I think traditionally most case studies are always done, you know, fairly soon after a project is completed. Right. And I think it's inherent. I think integrators want to, or manufacturers, they want to share this brand new device and how it solved all these problems. Like I understand where it's coming from. I thought what was interesting is during the interview questions, it gave you the opportunity to ask questions like, hey, how would you say your service has been with, in our case, with Hillman AV? And if you were to do that right after, a lot of times you that client, they wouldn't have the context or the experience to actually answer the question.
Yeah.
And so I almost was thinking, man, I think I might just start making a habit of that. And I might go maybe wait a year, and we don't do case studies on projects until they're a year old. And then we can leverage the client's ability to actually speak to what a working, not only what was the project relationship like, but what was the working relationship like following the post-install? Because that's where your success is, in the post-install, really.
Yeah, the day 30 experience versus the day one experience, right? I mean, many times there's a huge gap. I like this idea a lot of doing the case study after. I like it for a couple of reasons. You know, for anybody that follows like magazines and cars and stuff, when you're talking about it right now, I was just thinking about it. I'm like, it's almost like the difference between Motor Trend doing the car of the year, which is, you know, like nobody's bought it yet. It's the 2019, whatever is the car of the year. Right. Yeah. Based on who they put up versus Consumer Reports. Right. Which actually interviews owners of the cars, does the initial quality, how many services did you have in the first year? You know, there's two different methodologies there. There's one that you use for marketing buzz and push. And the other one can be used for marketing buzz and push as well in a different way, obviously. But I think what you did too is interesting, because you know, you tell me, you listened to the interviews. My takeaway on that is, isn't that a good interview to do 2 years in anyway, even if you're not doing a case study?
You're 100% right. Like you should be, and that's maybe the thing, is I think your account managers should be, if they're not already, you know, checking up or following up post 30 days, post 90, and then a year or something in that fashion.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have to video each time, but.
Yeah. I mean, so for me, there's been always two parts of why managed services are talked about all the time, obviously as revenue stream for AV. But for me, there have always been two reasons that managed services have been important as something to look at as an AV business. And the first reason is obviously there's a revenue stream there, and the customer, you know, gets that added bonus of their system being, you know, looked at and updated and proactively serviced and all those things. That's the business case of why, you know, you're going to do managed services from a revenue perspective and what the value add is for the customer. But secondarily, you know, when I was in residential AV, what it did was it actually made sure that the system was being used and adopted. Because if you were there on a regular scheduled basis asking about how things were working and how things were going, the odds that people were actually using the tools, or that you had an opportunity to help them overcome some small hurdle that they were having trouble with, the odds that you were able to help them overcome that and keep them in the use of the system over time became much, much, much higher, which meant they continued to be a client. You know, like if you're there proactively solving a puzzle once every 2 weeks and interacting with users and making sure people are using it, it's really hard for them to then go out and just hire someone else to do a job on a bid basis, because they go, well, these people are kind of an integrated part of our company in a way. And so I always found it interesting that we haven't done, you know, even if you don't have a services contract, having those three proactive visits from a technician may mean the difference between, you know, being the preferred vendor on the next bid and not.
It's also it's also that level up, I think, too, from your, you know, people always refer to it as the transactional relationship to that loyal, that loyalty relationship, right? That partnership.
Yeah.
So yeah, like, it's, I mean, in a case of a transactional relationship, you designed the project, you deployed the project, you installed the project, and you left, you know, like that. And that's it. They paid the money, you gave the product, and off you went. Whereas if you are doing that checkup, and I think you're right, it embeds you as a partner of the facility, right?
Yeah, and I think it helps you. Number one, it helps with the adoption over time and the ROI they're getting on the system. It also helps you in future design phases. But I think, you know, and I was talking about this on AV and the AM, a Chris Netto production, to name drop Chris Netto this morning, AV and the AM this weekend.
We haven't in a while.
I know we haven't. That's crazy.
I was out Sunday. I was antiquing, actually, but we can get into that later. So I missed most of the conversation, but
yeah
I think you know what's funny, right now we're actually doing this with another client that they've had a system for about a year now, and you know, to be honest, there have been significant challenges at this facility for us, and it ranges, the challenges range from I will say mediocre training at the beginning, and that's on us. That one, you know, and I'm gonna do some self-reflection in this one, but when I look back, we could have done better. We could have done better at what we trained them on, and how we managed the training, more so how we managed the training, I think, because we didn't demand that they put forward accountable people.
Yeah, there you go.
And so what ended up happening was we had some, you know, laissez-faire, which is French Canadian for I don't care people, come through the training. and so, you know, then those people, they didn't adopt the system. They didn't really pay attention. They didn't seem to care what we were showing them or the value of what we were showing them at that time.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then you had a rushed install because of construction timelines and you know, in all honesty, probably poor project management, both on the client side, and then we didn't manage the challenges that were being thrown at us well enough. And that's, it was a huge learning lesson. This was like a year long project.
Yep.
That we were on, and we just did not manage it well enough to get done what we needed to get done. We got the project done on time and everything, but it wasn't our standard. And we fell into the rush of the client, you know, and we're paying for it. But then when COVID hit, they let go of half of the employees that we trained. and then it just seemed like issue after. It's one of those projects that just never closed. You know, you know those ones? You always had to have something working for the project timeline that wasn't quite ready to be working yet. So you ignored your own processes, trying to go out of your way and appease the client, and then you pay for it. And so, you know, to be honest, right now we're a year past handover, and we have a list of changes and services and suggestions that we're putting forward back to them. Some of what they'll pay for, and some of that we're going to eat the cost on, because when we had finished, it wasn't our standard. You know, it was our mistake.
Yeah.
I'm very excited to do it.
I've seen that too, where, you know, you kind of step outside of those normal, you know, hey, this is the way we do a project, and this is how much time we need to stage, and this is the way that, this is the way that we like to come in after certain trades that are there. And then, you know, you get into the project, and like you said, there's a delay or something, and you're sympathetic. You want to be a good trade, and you want to be a good friend to the customer. So you make some small exception, you know, around those processes to move things forward, which causes more problems downstream, which causes, you know, like you said, you're kind of always now chasing your tail a little bit.
Yep.
And then, because you're being flexible, sometimes like things get a little shifty. I have a project that we're doing that it's in 7 different stages based on the stages of construction. So they're doing different rooms at a time because they occupy the building.
Yep.
So they can't do everything at once. And they're doing everything from construction to flooring to walls to paint to cabinetry to millwork while they're in the building. And yep. So they're really just shifting people from one area to the next. And then once that area is done, they have to move people somewhere else. And then you go over there and work there for a little bit.
Yep.
And so because of the nature of that, so many moving pieces, those stages are, you know, they're very, very hard to predict when they're going to need us there.
Yeah.
And they don't really have, so if one thing goes wrong, it's not like we can just push everything out 3 weeks because those people need to get back into another spot. They're in a temporary location working and it's usually not ideal. So, you know, there's not a lot of leeway as to, I almost think of it as Extreme Home Makeover. Right? Like, remember the show Extreme Home Makeover? Like, okay, we're going to take these people out of their house for a week and they don't know that their house is being redone and they're like on vacation for a week somewhere. And then all of a sudden they come home and their house is done. We worked on one of those when I was in residential in the Indian Reservation in Arizona. And dude, if any job site safety person had walked by, like this place would have been shut down on like 87 counts all at once because
you mean Ty and his bohemian flip-flops
were oh my good Lord. I mean there were people like carrying doors over their head, jumping over open ditches with rebar exposed, trying to get to the house as they're pouring the patio. I mean, our window to install was, you know, you need to be here sometime for AV. You need to be here sometime between 3 a.m. and 4:30 a.m. in the morning on such and such a day because their scheduled times are just 24/7 around the clock. But yeah, I think you kind of get in that mode. You're like, okay, this has to be done at this time. And you're trying to overlap and meet those things. When really, you know, really, I think when we have the relationship with the customer that we can say, hey, look, like, I really want to help you out, but I've seen this go terribly wrong. And I would just rather us right now understand that it's probably going to take an extra 2 days for it to be right. Or it's going to take an extra 6 days afterwards to get it right. So so we can either take the extra couple of days and do the pre-planning. And when we're out, or, you know, we're going to do our best, but odds are there are going to be some things that kind of come back to haunt us over the last 6-7 days based on skipping processes, et cetera, to try to get this done. And just ask them, would you rather miss 2 days or would you rather miss 6? You know, that's what happens.
We had that in this specific case where we were installing all the network and Wi-Fi throughout the facility as well. And two to three months before the site was going to be handed over, they wanted operational Wi-Fi and network. Mm-hmm. Well, all of that centrally located in room X. And guess what? Room X isn't built.
Yeah.
And so we're like, what do you want us to do here? Like, that's where all of our cabling is ran. That's where, you know, that's where the rack is going. That's where all the network switches are going. And so the room got built and then it was like, okay, it's good. Go and install your stuff. And so we're like, okay, you're sure the room is ready yet? Yeah. Okay. So we show up and well, lo and behold, like they're still, you know, they've got drywallers and they're sanding that. And I'm like, we can't install active fans in a room where you've got guys sanding this, you know, like you're crazy. And they, you know, you get into situations like that. And like you said, it's really tough. And often a few of us have said that we want to help the client so bad that at times it's to our own detriment.
Yeah. And to the client's detriment, really.
And then in the long term, it's to the client's detriment.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's a really hard one, I think, especially as a smaller business. It's a hard one to swallow because you need to, not that large organizations don't have hungry people, but you don't want to miss an opportunity. You don't want to lose an opportunity. And when you get into times like a pandemic or a slow economy,
Yeah.
You can't afford to miss any opportunity, but you also can't afford to work for 6 months and have made no money.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That's the truth too, right? That's that revenue is not good revenue.
Yeah. Right? No, that's right. Yeah. So I am really excited for this. We just did a site audit with them on our own dime. We've got a lot of things that we're going to be changing and investing in from our own dime to fix this system. And I'm excited because I look at it as a challenge, and I look at it as, I don't care what it costs. What's the cost of losing your integrity? Like that's the road I'm going. Is what's the cost of losing our integrity? Because the way that this project was managed, it's not who we are.
Yeah.
And so this is our chance to show this client who we actually are, and hopefully build a working, longer lasting relationship with them, a positive one.
Yeah, that's good. You know, and sometimes you don't get those second chances. So I think there are two things good there. Number one, that you got the chance. Number two, that you realize that, you know, I think sometimes as integration companies, we know all the stuff that we did, and we get in this mode where we kind of justify to ourselves that that's the best we could have possibly done on that job.
Yeah.
Right. And we don't really look at those opportunities where, like, okay, where did we have some opportunities to maybe rein things in or to say something that might have been a little uncomfortable at the time, but saved us a lot of headaches later. And we don't take a good look in the rear view and assign ourselves accountability for some of the things that maybe we could have had a better outcome with, right? And so I think it's mature of your company to look and say, you know what, this job was a crapshoot, and a lot of things were out of our control, but there are four or five opportunities that we really missed here that we could have done better on, and that would have given us better result. And I like that. I'm a huge fan of transparency in general.
Yeah, with clients. You're not losing anything by being transparent. I can tell you right now, you typically, if you are an authentic and overall positive company, you will never lose anything by being transparent. Because I think you said something important there, is we don't assign enough accountability to ourselves. And you see this a lot. I see this a lot on user interface designs, right? When the client is 3 months into a 3 months past handover, and they're still saying, I don't understand how to use this. I can't make this room work.
Yeah.
And then you get your own team pushing back, going, well, how could they not understand it? It's so simple. You know, things like that. And so there's a bit of truth to that, but I look at it and I go, well, okay, what do they, it is simple in the sense that every transport command on a normal remote is now on that keypad. How could they not understand that? Doesn't matter. They don't. Okay, let's figure out what they would understand. Like, that's the beauty of automation and control, right? That's the fun part of it. Is look if you want a button that says magic meeting because that's what they call it, and when they walk in they hold a magic meeting, then make a button that says magic meeting and make it do the 12 things that this room needs to do so that it makes sense to them.
You know? Yeah, that's those two things are huge, I think, in the whole scheme of pleasing customers.
What drives me crazy is, like, it doesn't have to be called video conference scene. It doesn't have to be called teleconference scene. It doesn't have to be called presentation scene. It can be called San Diego office meeting, because that's all they do with video conferencing. All they do with video conferencing is they meet with the San Diego office.
Yeah.
And it can be called quarterly board meeting, because when they come in and they have a quarterly, and they only have a quarterly board meeting, they press quarterly board meeting, that's how it works. Or make a phone call, you know, like, instead of teleconference, it could be make a phone call.
it's vernacular.
It's
all vernacular. And I think there's a huge conversation around this. Like, does a customer call you know, when the customer switches at home, when they switch their TV from the Xbox to the cable box, what do they call that? Like just asking people, what do you call that? Oh, I'm switching. Do they say that's switching sources? Do they say they went from input one to input two? What do they say they did? Yeah. You know, because the way they describe it is probably the best way to start to get some idea of what those words need to be for people to understand it better. And
that's
it's
a good way of looking at it.
You know, I and Commercial Integrator has done one on this. I did one on this about passing the Google test. You know, people don't call it video conferencing or video teleconferencing. Video call. Yes. You know, right? Like that's what people call it. So why aren't we calling it that, at least in our interfaces that are customer facing? Like we might not like that vernacular on the back end because maybe there's technical detail between the two. But the point is the customer thinks, oh, I need to make a video call. Then great. Then the button should say, make a video call. Right. I mean, it's just like you said, we have the ability to do these things, but we kind of get stuck in this world where the engineers, and this is like to go back to the design of everyday things. Have you read that book or started to read that book? Don Norman, The Design of Everything. So Don Norman wrote a book called The Design of Everyday Things. And it's a kind of the Bible for designers. So if you like books you want to know about UI, UX, it's called The Design of Everyday Things. And so they talk about objects have discoverability, like innate discoverability, right? Where you don't have learned behavior and that there should be affordances, which are, you know, pieces of the design that hint at what the function is, right? So and one of the examples of this is like the oldest known tool to man. You know, it has like a groove on one side and a pocket on the other, and then it's sharp on one end and rounded on the other. And when you look at it, you know that fits in your hand and your thumb goes in the groove.
Right.
And you break things open with it, right? It's like it's like a knife hammer, you know, it's made out of a rock. But if you are a human being and you pick that up, you know how it fits in your hand. You know exactly what to do. Yeah. Or scissors. They say scissors. You look at scissors. Okay, they're a sharp end. I'm not going to put my hand on the sharp end. There are these holes on one side. One hole is small. The other hole is larger. So like two or three fingers can go in one hole. My thumb goes in another hole. If I open it, they open. If I close it, they close. And it cuts things, right? Like, but and the device will still work if I flip it around and put my thumb in the big hole and might try to throw three fingers in the other hole. It just won't be as comfortable or as efficient, but it still works even when used slightly different than designed. So it's this whole book about this thing. And the other thing are about doors. So the other big example they use in this is doors. You know, a handle denotes pull and a plate denotes push.
I've called a couple doors out for being wrong.
Yeah.
Where they have a pull handle on a push door. And you're like, why do you have a pull handle here?
It's lazy. Because they wanted to put the same part on both sides of the door, and that's what they did, right? I mean, it's lazy design, and it implies you do something with the device different than what you would actually do with it. So if anybody's listening and likes books and wants one on design, The Design of Everyday Things is a really cool book on all of these things. And one
I'm gonna order it today.
Yeah, and he's real big on we can't blame users for not being able to use the things that we design. It's poor design. You know, and he said, you know, the problem with most, especially technology, is that it's designed by engineers who think logically, but most people don't think like engineers. So you can't let the engineer dictate what the user interface is because they think in a logical process with a high level of knowledge about what they're talking about. You have to have a different perspective.
Your transport command.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Please press the transport command for which you wish to see.
Yes. What are you talking about? And this is why, you know.
Please select your video input source. You know.
Yeah.
And what's funny is, we're guilty of this too, man. This is something I'm really trying to improve upon us, especially as we as a company are getting more intuitive on our control systems and. Really looking at the way we're designing systems less isolated and more ecosystem, especially with the push for AV over IP and stuff. It's really making me look at that. And I've had to battle a couple times where, like, well, we need to make the client a manual. And I'm going, okay. I understand why you want to make the client a paper manual on how to use the system. I get it. And I understand why the client wants a laminate piece of paper beside this touch panel for everyone to know how to use it. But let me ask you this. Have you ever read the manual for Zoom?
Yeah.
Have you ever read the manual for Outlook? Have you ever read that? Have you ever read that? No. The idea is that it's so intuitive and it's so basic and it just makes so much sense to the user that they really can figure it out themselves with minimal risk to damaging the system.
Yeah.
Now, in advanced features, and engineers love putting this on, don't engineers love the advanced button, advanced controls. They love the tab, right? They love the tab where it's like advanced controls. In case you're really tech savvy and you want to venture into the advanced controls, here's a tab for you. And so that's what you Google and that's what you YouTube, right? You go, okay, I know how to use Outlook, 70% of it. But I want to know, how do I have automatic rules set up so that when an email comes from person X with this subject line, I want it to filter into this inbox? Yes.
Yeah.
That's on the advanced page.
Yeah. Mail merge or any of those things, right? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's and I mean I'm Jocko Willink. I'm gonna Jocko this whole thing. I'm gonna Jocko and be like, okay, didn't deploy the system as well as you would have liked to. Good. Now we have a chance to go back and fix what we should have, you know? Didn't train the client on how to use the system properly the first time? Good. Now we have a chance to go back and show them how to actually use it and make changes in how they use it, right?
So. Yeah. And going in, like I said, like this accountability and transparency piece to drive that home. I mean, it reminds me of a line from Walk the Line, the Johnny Cash movie, where he's about to perform in Folsom Prison and the warden comes up and he's like, if you could not sing any songs that remind them that they're in prison, you know, that would be great. And he goes, you think they forgot?
Yeah.
You know, just kind of like, you know, going to a customer and saying, this didn't go, you know, like we really want to make this right. We feel like this job didn't go as smooth as it could have went. And we feel like there were some opportunities for improvement. And we really want to make sure that we make that right. It's not like the customer doesn't know that already. Like you're not exposing anything by acknowledging the reality. The customer felt it. They might not know the extent of what happened behind the scenes or where things need to be fixed or anything, but they know that it wasn't perfect. They felt your stress. They lived the job with you while you were doing it. So you're not losing anything by acknowledging it. I think you actually lose something by pretending that everything went the way you wanted it to. You know, like then you seem like you're delusional.
What do you mean they don't understand how the keypad works? Well, it's clear as day. It says guide. It says channel up and down. It says it says source here. You know.
Yeah.
How do they not understand that?
What do you mean? Yeah, it's perfectly obvious to me. I think we get in that mode. You know, and I think sometimes though too. I think sometimes, people get mad at me for saying this too. You know, some of the things that we do really aren't proprietary enough to for us to try to protect them as a trade secret.
Oh, right? I can't believe you said that. I'm so angry that you said that.
To actually take the time to tell somebody how something works or why something may be hard to change or XYZ, which we don't do enough sometimes. We kind of just say, well, hey, I'm the trusted expert. You need to trust me. This is what we need to do. Great. But if they have an extra question, it's okay. I mean, I even had a friend who joined an AV company. He was from the construction industry. He worked for a company that did like outsourced CAD and things like that. And he sold CAD services to home builders. Well, he was a really great salesperson. He's a really great relationship builder and he's super smart. And so he could learn AV. Wasn't a big thing for him to learn. So he got into an AV company as their salesperson. And he knew me. We used to do sales calls together when I was in AV. And so he would call me and ask me questions about things. And one day he called me and he said, why are my engineers internally, why are they so difficult to talk to internally in his own company? And I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, so I go to the job site. He goes, I'm learning. Like I'm new. I'm learning, right? I go to the job site and I take a needs analysis and we figure out what's going on. And I go back and I give it to them and they engineer a system and I'm going to go present it to the customer. And so I want to just make sure I understand what's in it because, you know, me having somewhat of a novice view, I'm going to read this differently than somebody that's been in this industry for 20 years. So he goes through the scope of work and then he'll see something like, you know, $1,200 for an HDMI extender, right?
Yep.
Pretty standard. Send receive unit over Cat 5 has to go through the wall. Yep. It's expensive. It's not a $50 cable. It's a $1,200 unit. He goes, well, I'm going to give this to the customer. The customer is going to ask me what this piece of gear is and why it's so expensive, you know, or what at least it does. So he'll say,
why do I need to spend $1,200 on running HDMI 100 feet?
So that's what he asked.
Yeah.
Pretty much. So why do we have this $1,200 box in here for connecting the TV to the switcher? And the engineer's answer was, well, how else am I supposed to get HDMI signal over there? How else am I supposed to do that?
That's such an engineer response too, right? And right? I know we're picking on them, but you know what's funny is they're good at their jobs because of that line of thinking, but it does present challenges.
Yeah. So like, obviously if you know AV and you know what the challenge is in getting signal that far and that HDMI is not going to extend and that these boxes are expensive and that if you don't use something like that, what's going to happen is you're not going to get signal or it's not going to communicate that way. That's great.
Well, that's
but as opposed to just saying like, well, duh, like you need it to get it from here to there. You know, sometimes there's that soft touch of, yeah, I know it's crazy, right? Like for me, I would even tell a customer it's crazy, right? Like, you know, the cables are $50 and then you have to spend $1,000 to extend them. But this technology really wasn't made to go over 25 feet. Well, and what happens is when we push it, especially through a building where we're going to go over and down and up and back and we have 75, 80 feet, the last thing you want is an intermittent signal. And there may be a way to do this a little cheaper with an active cable or something, but depending on what's going on in the room, which lights are on, et cetera, like it could just break it all of a sudden. So this
or the actual route from A to B. What does the actual route in the ceiling look like? But you know what? If that was the answer from the engineer, they'd be in sales.
True. That's true. And this is a conversation that I remember from AV and AM, although I didn't remember the one earlier, that we were talking about sales and engineering. And, you know, some of the folks were saying, you know, if a salesperson ever did the site survey on their own, like I would throw something through the wall, like they do not need to be on site doing a site survey. And my perspective was, well, geez, these people, I told one of them, the four or five people that are saying this, I totally agree with you that an engineer is going to see more technical detail, most likely than a salesperson on site. I also would say that you're coming from a perspective of you have a company big enough that has separate sales engineers and salespeople. But when I worked in AV, I didn't have a sales engineer. I had a project manager, but when I went to site, I had to assess that. And when I did my bids, I had to do my bids down to the mod plug, the Cora plate and mud ring. I mean, if I didn't put the right amount of mud rings on the order, they didn't get ordered. Like we didn't just have trucks full of stuff. We were doing project-based work and ordering for projects.
Yeah.
So.
I think that's typically. Yeah, we have like an inventory of miscellaneous parts, obviously, but you don't want to miss it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the idea of a project is to get right down to the details of everything. But yeah, you know, I think that's why I'm excited. And the other thing that I'll say about what this is going to cost us money to go in. It is going to cost quite a bit of money to go in and repair this. But if you are hesitant to go back and maintain your integrity with the client by spending some money, I would advise that you not be hesitant because doing this will not put you out of business. Doing this 100 times redoing your work and being being transparent and spending the money to make things right when you have made the mistake, it will not put you out of business. What will put you out of business is not learning from those experiences, improving your processes to prevent that from happening. Yeah. Because yes, doing this 100 times a year, that will put you out of business. But it wasn't the protection of your integrity that put you out of business. It was that you didn't improve as you did that. Like, you know, yeah. You know what I'm saying? So
100%
loss of a business. Yeah.
So I'll tell you one story on Resi real quick. And I think I've told the story in different podcasts before, but the worst business phone call I ever got in my life was where we made repeated mistakes on someone's home when I was on Resi. And we flat out, the first time we forgot to do something, they bought rubber back boxes for speakers, right? So long and short, rubber back boxes supposed to be behind the speakers, isolating the speaker, creating some kind of enclosure, but they were kind of rubberized so that they could fit through a standard hole. You didn't have to build them in pre-construction. You could squeeze them through the hole and then mount the speaker to them.
Nice.
Yeah, right. Didn't put them in. So customer gets in the house, speakers sound bad. He's an engineer. He pulls 4 screws, pulls the speaker out, no back box. Okay, they forgot to put the back boxes behind the speakers, gives us a call. We go back out to put the back boxes behind the speakers, put the back boxes behind the speakers, put the speakers back in the wall. Don't put, like, we lose some grills, like bend some stuff up, leave the job site, don't say anything to the customer about the things that are there. He does a quality inspection. Yeah, great, back boxes are here, but now we've got all these other problems with the speakers because you guys, you know, messed up the grills and those kind of stuff. Okay, great. We'll go back, we'll fix the grills, we'll do a little cleanup on our work because we didn't do it right. Go back the third time. Everything's good, looks good when they leave, put the grills back on the speakers, all that kind of stuff. Customer decides just to do a quick check on our work again, just to make sure. Well, I don't know if you've ever seen like in-wall speakers, many of the brands of in-wall speakers, they have 6 screws that hold an in-wall speaker to the bracket. But they're not symmetrical. So the bracket has an orientation. The 2 screws are 3 inches apart and the other 2 screws are 4 inches apart, right? So they had taken the speaker out, put the back box through the bracket, done whatever they needed to do. When they put the speaker back in, they put it in upside down originally. So the middle holes didn't line up
with
the actual, you know, places that the screws needed to go. So, you know, they're just going to be behind a grill. So slams the grill back on, throws the 2 speakers or the 2 screws in the garbage, doesn't use those 2 screws because he doesn't want to back the 4 out, flip the speaker over, put the speaker back in and use all 6.
Yeah.
Customer sees this and then I get the phone call again. And this phone call starts like this, Jared. And when we're talking about like your integrity, right? We're talking about integrity. We're talking about the first time didn't cost us our integrity or money as a company, right? Like it's an opportunity to learn. We didn't learn. Our team didn't learn twice. So the third time I got the phone call and the phone call starts like this. Mark, let me tell you something about professional integrity. And that's the first line of the call. And I'm like, oh no. And
like, what time is it?
what can I say?
Yeah.
Right. Like there's no excuse for what happened. There's no, number one, maybe we forgot the back boxes, not a standard thing we do. Sorry about that. Number two, we did shoddy work. Well, you know, I apologize for that. Number three, we just outright know we did something wrong and throw parts away. Like it's, there's nothing there's no explanation at that point. And I said, I can send somebody. He goes, no, nobody's coming back in my house.
Yeah.
He goes, what you're going to do is you're going to go to your office and you are going to get me 8 screws for these speakers and you're going to drop those off to me and I'm going to fix them myself. And I said, okay, sir. And I went back. I ended up at his house at 8 at night, handed him some screws, apologized. He took the screws, walked through, and I'm sure he went back to his home builder and asked for some type of refund or something based on what they had paid through the home builder for us to do the work. But you're right. You have to take that opportunity to learn. And you have to care. Like I remember one time too, I did some work here for a company, not for the company I'm with now, but I did some work here for a company, for a big aerospace company. And we went in there and I was looking through the room because we were going to do a handover. And I moved the credenza where all the stuff sat. And I noticed the wall plates were crooked behind the credenza. I don't know if it needed to be adjusted at the box or mudring level, or if it just needed the plate to be adjusted slightly or whatever it was, but they were crooked. And so I told the guys, I'm like, hey, we have to do that. And it's like, well, we were in a hurry. I'm like, I get it, but we need to fix it. You know? And so when I went to go get the contractor who was managing our job, and they go, let me show you something. And I'm like, are you going to show me the plates behind the credenza? And she said, yes, I am. And I said, already got it handled. They're working on it right now, you know, but acting like there would be nothing there, or being, oh, it's behind a piece of furniture, nobody's going to see it.
Like, and we've done that where I've gone in to do like maybe like the handover or the training with a client, and I've seen, and then, and I go, I see behind a display, mm-hmm. You know, that's probably a very common place where you see just rat's nests of hodgepodge, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember one job a while ago where I went in, that's exactly what I went in to go and help the client get going with a meeting. It was their first time with this system. And so they wanted me to come on site and just help them understand how they would start the meeting and et cetera. So I went and I saw behind the TVs, it was a dual display video conferencing system. And I look behind the displays and I'm just like, what the hell? And I remember their meeting wasn't for a while. I called my project manager who oversees that kind of stuff. And I said, you need to get here right now. And my background is install. So I think I have a keener eye for things like that than maybe some. And I dragged them out to site. I had my tools in my truck. So we took both those TVs down. We recabled everything behind those displays.
Yep.
We cable managed it all cleaner. We cleaned it up, and I wasn't about to charge the client for that. It was garbage, you know? So
I thought that's why they did. I mean, I thought the reason that RF connectors screwed on and that we did strain tests on our compressions was because we just hang cable boxes from coax behind TVs without any other structure back there. I mean, I see that often. Isn't that what it's for? It's a hang test, exactly.
Yeah. So one thing before we
yeah, end we got to wrap. Yeah. But yeah.
But I think what I would be interested to hear, and I'll tell one more story because I think it's hilarious. So I get we don't do residential. We've done a few houses, and we did one really high end house within the last couple of years, and this house in particular, it's a beautiful home. You know, they have everything in this house is automated, right? Like right down from the fireplace to the pool to the lighting, the shades, everything. Everything in this house is automated. Anyways, I get a call from the client when they go to watch a movie in one of the rooms where they have a 7.1 system. And they say, hey, it sounds really like muffled. Like it sounds, it doesn't sound good. I'm like, really? Yeah. That's kind of strange, right? So anyways, I said, okay, I send someone out, and they kind of do a bit of an investigation. They go, okay, yeah, he's right. It does sound, we're jammed at this time, so it's really hard to get back to previous projects, and everyone's been in experience with that where you're popping in and out of clients, service calls and stuff. And so all I get back is like, yeah, something is wrong with those speakers, and I'm thinking, okay, you know, check with the installers. How did you wire it? Is everything, is the polarity wrong or whatever? And so the system is so large to go back and check physical wiring is a little bit cumbersome. So I grab a polarity checker. You ever used one of these?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right. That's what they're called, right? A polarity checker. And you basically put a tone, this like beeping tone through the speaker.
Yep.
And I go and I'm using this polarity meter and it's changing whether or not it's in, like whether or not, polarity or phase, which one?
Phase,
sorry. Yes, yep. I didn't sound right. So, and my meter is changing whether or not this speaker's in phase, then it isn't. I'm going, what the heck? And so I pull a grill down. Well, not every speaker has this, but these ones do. And these are Snap AV They're Snap AV home theater speakers, and they have dust cover handle hand plastic pieces that go over
the actual painting and stuff. Yeah.
They go, well, no. They go, so during install.
Oh, gotcha.
When you are pushing your speaker into place.
Yeah.
There's this plastic cover over the driver or over the speaker itself to protect it from your hand pushing up on it.
Okay.
Well, our installers, whoever it was at that time, I don't know, maybe it was one of our newer guys, didn't take it off. You're supposed to remove it. And so,
because it blocks airflow.
Because it blocks everything. Yeah. So here I've got these seven speakers and I'm sitting and I'm on a ladder in front of the client. And I've got to look like the biggest idiot ever, pulling each one of these dust covers off, basically, you know. And then as soon as I did, I mean, the system sounded amazing. I just thought,
like, hey, I fixed it.
Well, there goes
I'm an audio genius.
Yeah. Oh, why didn't you take these off? That we leave these on for clients to take off. It's like the new stickers on phones. You know how we want you to peel those off.
It reminds me of when I pulled, I had a room like that in a house once years ago where I pulled I pulled the volume control off because, you know, the home run from the amplifier goes to the volume control and then the speakers run back to the volume control and then usually impedance matching if you have multiple speakers on one zone so you don't blow up the amp. So I was pulling the thing off just to check to make sure the impedance setting was right on the volume control. And when I pulled out the volume control to check that setting, you know, there was 16 gauge two conductor coming from each speaker to the volume control like you would normally see, and then typically we would run 16.4 back to the head end. You know, the head end wire was a piece of Cat 5 that they had just taken some of the 24 gauge wire and used that as the. So I don't know if they ran out of 16.4 on the site.
Yeah,
but they had a piece of category cable trying to run all that voltage into the volume control, and it wasn't sounding great, and I don't know that it would have lasted long term, but that was a fun retrofit to try to now
get
you know, in a finished home with the electronic equipment on an exterior wall, which means it's full of fire block and insulation. So we had a lot of drywall repair on that job for sure. Well, awesome, man. I think, you know, hey, we went through kind of like nightmares, best practices, case studies, learning.
Integrity.
We name dropped Jocko and Chris Netto. I remembered one thing from AV in the AM and forgot something else that I may put on Twitter later if I remember it. But I think we have to wrap, man.
Yeah, no, that's good enough for this morning.
Well, cool.
Yeah, it was a good time, though.
Hey, everybody, thanks for joining us on AV Daybreak. We will definitely see you next time. And there may be something coming up with Avixa soon. So stay tuned for that. Take care.